Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Is there anything else that you're ready to go?
I'm ready to go, man.
It's your first time. You do have a sheet of paper now. Okay. Well, in that case, let us get started. Welcome to episode 4 of Real World Theology. I am your host, Fizz. This week, we'll be tackling Despicable Me 2, and to a certain extent, Despicable Me 1, and to a certain extent, children's movies in general, though I don't expect to speak for every single children's movie. So in Despicable Me, we see a lovable bad guy, or evil villain, who has his heart transformed by the surprising love of three little girls. It's a tale of redemption, love, dreams, and being comfortable in your own skin. And it raises a lot of questions about what's good, what's bad, who the hero is or should be, and kind of what we value in life. So I thought it appropriate to try to tackle. And to this point, we have not done any children's movies or animated movies. And so much like everything else, almost every episode, we're treading new water. So this week I am joined as a solo guest. I've had two people every week or every show. But this week, Alan Hawkins, the senior pastor at Church of the Redeemer in Greensboro, is my solo guest. I would assume simply because his wealth of knowledge is so large, it's like having two incredibly smart people here.
Right.
So, yes. So Alan, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, Alan, you are a father of a zillion small children.
That's right.
Okay, so to put you on the spot, name all your children.
Joshua, Emily, Athan, Kieran, Ryan. 12, 10, 7, 5, 3.
Okay, was that 4 or 5?
That's 5.
Okay. Are you sure?
I'm positive.
If we go back and listen to this.
No, it's 5, I promise.
Okay. So one of the reasons, besides just being a really compelling speaker and thinker, that I had Alan on is because, like I said, he is the father of a number of children. And for marketing purposes, Despicable Me is a children's movie. Mm-hmm. Despicable Me 2 is a children's movie. So before we even get into the movies themselves, like as a father, like what do you look for? Or are you even cautious when like you take your children to movies? Do you like taking your children to movies? What reasons do you have to take your children to movies?
Great question. I actually, in the family dynamic, am probably the least cautious of movie content. You know, I'm not going to take my child, obviously, to an R-rated movie. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's okay to expose children to more than some people like to, mm-hmm. simply because they're going to be exposed to it anyway. So you can't really shelter and protect. And I think kids' movies in general are, as a father of 5 and life is sometimes crazy, it's nice to put in a good movie that the kids want to watch and it allows us to check out. That's one reason. Secondly, there are themes that all of these movies contain that I know our children absorb that theme. And they feel the impact of that. They think about it. Even at their level. And so I think that's great too, because it does create conversations that we have or illustrations of, hey, remember in that movie that character did that, that are teachable moments. So third, I think it's a great family outing. This summer we saw Despicable Me for the first time because a local library worked with movie theaters to get movies donated for free. So you could come in, sit in a movie theater, have that experience, and it was free. But of course, we all bought popcorn, which benefited the movie theater.
Yeah.
But I thought that was great. And so as a family, we love to go to movie theaters. It just happens to cost us a lot more to do one. So we try to space it out.
Well, I already like your answer because I'm not sure if you heard when we had Elijah on, the only other pastor we've had on. When I asked him a question, he had a 3-point response.
Well, you're trained.
Yeah, so
it's a seminary
so
class.
I love the fact that both of you had three points.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you were aware of the narratives that children's movies have. Mm-hmm. And I think that alone makes you kind of, I guess, more aware than some of the parents that I've talked to. Because most of the time when I see parents or I hear about parents putting on a movie or taking their kids to the movie or dropping their kids off at the movie,
right.
It seems to be like a babysitter and nothing more. So knowing that these movies have narratives, and hopefully most of them, since they're for children, are fairly acceptable for children. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any narratives in a children's movie that would make you not want to allow your kids to see that movie? Like, do you have any children's movies that are kind of like off limits? Not because, you know, like obviously they have probably sex or anything like that in like, I'm not expecting you to let them see Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
I mean, I would use an example in this movie. There's a part where Dr. Nefario says, it's no fun being good. You know, it's his resignation from making jellies and mundane life instead of the high action of crime. So the thing about themes like that is if you allow those messages to go unchallenged, then people begin to absorb them and think that way. And so the flip side of that is it can actually be fun being good, which is what Dr. Nefario switches on.
Mm-hmm.
So why I wouldn't want to guard them from something, I think you don't want to leave it unchallenged or undealt with. And so I'm fine for them to watch the movies, but I want to debrief or unpack what they've seen and not just let it go on their own.
So do you often have your children come up to you and ask you questions about the movie?
Yeah.
I know I'm putting you on the spot with this one too, so you might not have one off the top of your head, but do you have an example of maybe a movie outside of Despicable Me that they've come up and asked you about?
Well, yes. I let them watch The Hobbit.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of those moments where...
let all of them watch The Hobbit?
Well, they've all seen it, but then I went and rented it and played it, and Ryan, the youngest, is scared and has to leave the movie, and you know, then it's the second guessing. Wow, maybe I shouldn't have watched The Hobbit. So, but one of the children asked me about the theme in The Hobbit of the bad guy and how the bad guy is scary, and why does the bad in The Hobbit it looks like the bad guys are winning, especially when they kill the dwarf king.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, so are the bad guys going to get me?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are those moments when, sorry for that spoiler. There are those moments when it's something that stands out to the kids and it can't leave their mind. So that one particular child kept asking me about it. The thing, I would add something that I think what's fascinating with animated movies is that, and especially these movies that are marketed and targeted as kids' movies, they're really not kids' movies. I think the really neat and creative thing about them is they are actually very deep and thoughtful situations that are gussied up as a kid movie. But a movie like Despicable Me speaks to adults just as much as kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think they're so popular. And you couldn't make a movie with real actors that has that kind of silliness to it and be taken serious by adults. But adults take a movie like this seriously because it's animated and for kids. And I just find that really interesting. So,
well, I'd say that observation alone was probably one of the reasons that I think Pixar caught on very big.
Exactly.
I mean, the first time I watched Toy Story, and I really hope to do a Real World Theology on the Toy Story movies, as they're some of my favorites. I mean, I know kids like it, and they're like, hey, Woody, hey, Buzz, and they're buying all the toys.
Yeah.
But, like, I am, like, breaking down watching those movies.
Oh, I've got goosebumps. So I was teasing some of the guys in our congregation. I was like, have you all seen Toy Story 3? And they said, oh, yeah, it's a good movie. I said, did you cry? And, you know, under their breath, a couple of people said, yeah, I did, because even though it's targeted as a kid's movie, the themes are real profound themes for our heart. And so they're applicable to both adults and kids.
Well, do you feel like the messages or the themes are more out front because it is a kids movie, so they're not trying to hide it?
Exactly.
So it's almost like you're getting past the, we have to think too hard about it, we have to disguise it with all this like false drama or melodramatic situations, and you just deal with like friendship or love or loss. And so since you're not dressing it up, you know, it's almost like, I think of like when Christ is like, you know, let the children come to me, or have faith like a child. You know, you're talking about stop trying to pretend that you're smarter than you really are, or that you need to dress it up more.
Yeah. I remember a experience in my own life where I got a girl who picked on me that I liked, and, you know, in a public setting and made fun of me, and how it just, ninth grade, unraveled me. And so the scene where Gru is on the playground and is trying to ask the girl whatever he was going to ask her, and they, you know, it's ooh, and he's got Gruties and all that sort of thing. That's a very kid-like moment, but every adult has been in that scenario or understands the pain of that. So while it's funny and kid-oriented, it's deeply profound for adults.
Well, excellent. Well, I mean, like I said, I wanted to kind of cover that general idea because, like I said, I think it would do a disservice to review or whatever you call what we do here, a kid's movie without addressing the whole concept of things being directed towards children or, you know, the idea. Because kids' movies in themselves, they're usually one of the number one, you know, I think it was 2010, like of the top 20 movies, top 20 grossing movies, I believe like 15 of them were animated movies.
Exactly.
You know, because parents are taking their children like in droves to see these things. And if like a kind of say in the intro that movies are modern day pulpits, our children are the ones getting preached to.
Exactly.
More than anybody else. So I wanted to hit on that, just food for thought, but kind of sliding into the actual movie itself. To talk about Despicable Me 2, I feel it would be a disservice not to talk about Despicable Me. More briefly on Despicable Me. Did you enjoy the first Despicable Me movie?
Loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, it ranks up there with one of the best of the animated movies. We just saw Hotel Transylvania. It's okay. You know, father, love, sick daughter, that sort of thing. It's just okay. This Despicable Me, I thought was fantastic. I still would say Toy Story 1 and 3 are the best of the, that's the upper echelon. Despicable Me 1 is really close.
Really close?
Yeah,
for me. Yeah, well, and I feel the same way. I think the Toy Story movies, especially once, hopefully one day, anyone listening out there,
sign me up for 3.
Yeah, I mean, like there is so much going on in those movies, and I think they're kind of like the thing that's raised
pen
up.
Penultimate.
Yeah, the penultimate, and everything else is compared to them. I believe when you talk about good animated movies, but I feel the same way. What was it though about Despicable Me that you really liked? I mean, surely there had to be something that grabbed you. I mean.
Well, I mean, in a just the minions, of course, are they steal the show. They're so cute and funny and all that. I thought there was more about them in the second one than the first one. But I like the theme, you know, a person who has been bad all their life has an opportunity to do good. And I think that's because inwardly we are all created to do good. So, Gru is this excellent criminal who has a chance to redeem or do something of value. That's a compelling story. The other story that I think was so compelling is that for him to adopt the girls and become other focused. I mean, he's a bachelor, does whatever he wants, goes wherever he wants. Obviously, resources are no issue for him. You know, for him to have to learn to do bedtime stories and take care of kids, breaks down his own self-interested, self-focused life, and brings out the best in him. So when you're forced to serve and be self-sacrificial, it brings out the best out of you. And I thought that theme came through big in Despicable Me. The third thing that was very powerful in that movie, and I don't always have 3 points.
I'm pretty sure you always have 3 points.
Right. Is there's a moment where his mom is just critical of him. And the pain of watching that and knowing how words spoken, whether they're when you're little or old, are immensely powerful. And, you know, that you can tear someone down and set them under a shadow of failure and gloom with the power of words. And so I think those were the three big standouts for Despicable Me that made it such a great movie. And, you know, the characters are funny.
Well, I think it's funny that you basically hit on all the main themes of Despicable Me that I was hoping that we hit on.
Sorry.
Because I'm sure, you know, being so close to God as a pastor,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, and see, that's what I love what you're talking about, because I saw the same thing. And when you're talking about, like, kind of love following action, mm-hmm. because last week, last time on the podcast, we talked about Much Ado, mm-hmm. and in Much Ado, it reminded me very heavily of a sermon by Tim Keller, because mm-hmm. He points out in one of his marriage sermons that lots of times by acting loving, you become loving.
Right.
And, you know, we talked about that with mm-hmm. Beatrice and Benedict and stuff like that. And I think the same thing happens to Gru. And,
exactly.
And I don't know if when they sat down to write Despicable Me, if that's one of the things that they were thinking that they were going to be telling as a truth.
Right.
You know, but that's what they show. They show a man who is using children as a means to an end.
Right.
You know, but to keep them around for his end, he has to act loving to them,
right.
and he has to start, you know, following the actions of kindness, and that develops into love. He becomes loving,
right?
And it changes him.
It does, and that's fulfilled when you see him in Despicable Me 2 in the Tooth Fairy suit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he would kind of humble himself and humiliate himself to please Agnes. And it's just sweet, very touching how she comes up and says, "You're the best Tooth Fairy ever. I know it's you, Gru. I'm just playing this for the other kids." You know, I think that's just a great scene. So,
well, as far as the other things that play out in the first Despicable Me that are going to affect kind of how we view Despicable Me 2, another thing that, you know, you already mentioned is talking about how words mm-hmm. can really just crush us.
Right.
Well, they can crush us or they can lift us up.
Yeah.
Words spoken and the power of words and the power of or the trajectory that a child can have
mm-hmm.
if his dreams are kind of stomped on. And we see in the first movie that Gru really wants to be an astronaut. He wants to go to the moon. He wants to
right.
do it. So over the course of that, the movie, even though they don't directly say it, we basically see him trying to steal the moon,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, it's silly that he wants to steal the moon, but ultimately, I mean, it's basically just this big, almost metaphor for like something that he had a dream as a kid. And so we have to ask ourselves, once we see his backstory, once we get to know Gru,
mm-hmm.
We get to see into his life and he's not just this named villain.
Right.
We have to wonder, is Gru really bad?
Right.
You know, is Gru really an evil genius or a bad guy?
Right.
You know, is anybody bad or good? I mean, we start quickly taking small hops sure. to giant leaps to philosophy.
Sure. Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, like, do you think anywhere along the path, like, Gru was a bad guy?
Well, you know, it's really funny how the movie's careful not to show things that really are overtly awful to others. You know, he's obviously a bank criminal and he's, you know, stolen things and done all that. but you don't see that he really takes someone out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his, you know, he's rude to his neighbor.
Freezes some people in a latte line.
Right, yeah. But he doesn't, he's not killing anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that I think that what I see or what I experienced in watching that movie is he was so diminished in who he was. He obviously wasn't attractive. His mother was just vicious to him. That the way he got his affirmation in life was by being a bad criminal. I don't think he set out to be a bad criminal. I think that's how he got his kudos or his rewards, or someone would say, well, you're somebody because you've done this. So that's one aspect to it. The other one, when you ask about the whole badness and goodness spectrum, you know, what makes a person bad is a fascinating. I mean, that's a big Pandora's box.
Well, fortunately, we have like a whole other half hour.
Good. So, you know, this was interesting, but psychologists recently voted again. They kind of had a big convention and they decided that they were dealing with the old issue of, is our problem nurture or is it nature?
Mm-hmm.
So is it because of the environment we were raised in, or is it because of our genetics and who we are in our makeup, our DNA? And once again, they reaffirmed psychologists, American Association of Psychologists, that it's actually nature, not nurture. So I find that fascinating when we talk mm-hmm. about the issue of bad and good. But I felt like Gru was always a very good-hearted person. You know, he had minions. He wanted them to have jobs and mm-hmm. to have meaningful life. And so his way of fulfilling his own personal desires was to be this criminal.
Yeah.
But he really wasn't a criminal.
It was something that he could be good at, so he could have exactly. notoriety.
Yeah.
And then when Vector comes along and is obviously more bad,
right,
it kind of wrecks his whole paradigm again.
Exactly.
And so he has to rethink what his whole goal in life is, or his
exactly.
whole purpose
yeah.
in life. Well, all right, so if we take Gru, the reformed villain,
okay,
and move him into Despicable Me 2.
Right.
In Despicable Me 2, well, before we get to the themes, I guess I want to stop and say this. Did you enjoy Despicable Me 2?
Despicable Me 2 was, it's the similar experience of Toy Story. Toy Story 1, fantastic. Toy Story 2, it's okay. It's still a great show and worthy to see. I felt the same. I felt like in Despicable Me that they had to develop the person of Gru and the character of Gru more. And that's why the story kind of bogged down a little bit, kind of slowed down. Who is this guy? What's he really
mm-hmm.
dealing with? And I sense that his issue of his purpose in life and his contentment in life and his incompleteness in life, i.e. not having a romantic interest or what, really over that was the dominant show. So the evil guy and all that was just a secondary issue. The movie to me, Despicable Me, was about who is Gru and what's his purpose and hope in life. And that's why it was a little less of a hit, in my opinion, than the first one was.
So it was mostly thematic. I mean, like, it was almost totally thematic
yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
I'm sensing a theme. Because usually, and it's just the brief history we have doing this podcast so far, lots of times when I ask people how they liked a movie, like I said, they almost talk about the acting, the script,
right.
you know, things like that. But I love the fact that, like, your perspective is almost always thematic.
What was the theme going on? And you know, he's trying to figure out who he is mm-hmm. in his life. And he's sensing some sense of incompleteness with the spouse. You know, it's a fascinating scene where the little girl is reciting the thing and he gets onto her for
mm-hmm.
acting like a zombie. And then he hears what she's actually saying. And he gets up and he walks out real quick because it strikes him maybe that he didn't have a mom either like that, or that there's this incompleteness of a wife in his life or a spouse in his mm-hmm. life. And that little moment with Edith reminds him of that. And so that's what I felt like the movie was about. The incomplete crew.
Well, as a side question,
yeah,
you mentioned before that the Minions stole the show. So you're a Minions fan.
Big Minions fan. Okay. Yes.
Well, I'm not a super huge Minions fan. I feel like they were very distracting. So when I think of Despicable Me, I completely agree with you
yeah.
that Despicable Me is right below my, you know, my penultimate.
Right.
Now, given I like Toy Story 2 a lot.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be my favorite Toy Story.
Right.
But I would not compare it to Despicable.
It's still pretty good.
Yeah, it's still really, anyway. But the point of that, me saying that, is I felt Despicable Me 2 fell so short mm-hmm. of where Despicable Me did.
Exactly.
And I felt lots of that was because there was all these Minion antics. I mm-hmm. felt like in the first movie we had Minions kind of like putting an exclamation point on some scenes.
Right.
And kind of being like, haha, that kind of makes something serious.
Yeah.
Give some levity so it's still, you know, a funny kind of kids movie.
Right.
But in this one, I felt like there were scenes just so they could come out and be firemen. And I actually talked about this on another podcast where even though it's probably one of the things that kids are going to walk away and, you know, they're going to make the bee-doo-bee-doo noises right. a ton, I feel like that was a scene in Despicable Me 2 that if it would have been done in Despicable Me 1, you had Gru like reaching for the phone, being conflicted. We're learning a lot about Gru. We're learning about what drives him, what scares mm-hmm. him, and we're getting on the same page with him. In Despicable Me 1, I think there may have been like a Minion that did like something quickly funny
yeah.
and it would have moved on.
Right.
So at the end of the scene, we're still stuck with Gru being conflicted.
Yeah.
In Despicable Me 2, we see Minions come in, make you completely forget that he had just struggled trying to, you know, call this woman that he really liked. And so we almost miss out, I think, as an audience on the focus or the narrative that they were trying to do there. So I really didn't enjoy Despicable Me 2 that much
yeah.
because I think they went too much for the cheap laugh.
Well, and I think whether they know this or not, or it was intuitive, that it was almost necessary to buffer some of the serious themes of what Gru was struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost like there's this real serious theme of he's not married,
mm-hmm.
he's not attractive, blah, blah, blah. So let's do the antics to kind of keep the kids engaged in
mm-hmm.
that. So that's, I would agree, that diminished two from Despicable Me 1,
well,
in my opinion.
Well, I'll also tell you this. I know we hadn't had a chance to talk about this outside of the podcast,
mm-hmm.
so maybe it'll be great news for you to find out that there's going to be a Minions movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, just Minions.
Yeah.
So
that'll be one that I get on Redbox and babysit the kids. Yeah, exactly.
Completely against.
Right.
Daddy, why yeah. did the Minions keep hitting each other in the face?
Right. Just watch it.
Just watch it.
Enjoy. So.
Well, but with that said, I did like a lot of the where they seemed to be trying to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've hit on a lot of that already. And I kind of wanted to start with what new life looks like for Gru.
Yeah.
Because I really enjoyed the opening kind of scene where he does end up being like the fairy godmother.
Right.
Tooth fairy, whatever he's
right.
trying to squeeze into. And it's selfless. And we don't see that. We see, you know, we get the hint that that's the direction.
Yeah.
The trajectory that Gru's life is on
sure.
at the end of the first one, but we don't really see him embracing that, I think, to that point.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I think is Ephesians 4 says something like, throw off your old self,
mm-hmm.
you know, and live your new self. And the reality is to live a new self, change your way, so to speak, which is what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many old habits that make that such a challenge. And that's where I saw just this tension in Gru of, you know, I want to live the way I want to live, but now he's got the three girls
mm-hmm.
and he can't do that. So you know, he wants to go back into the bad work and the fun work. And he's telling his girls, I've got a new job. I'm going to be a spy. But there's this reality of he's got to go home and put kids to bed. Mm-hmm. And he can't run out and go to the restaurant, the salsa restaurant, until after he puts his girls down from bed. So mm-hmm. there's that tension of I have this new life or new constitution or new outlook, and yet I want to do some things like I used to do. And that's the struggle I saw in him.
I mean, and I don't feel like it was probably, once again, what the writers were intending.
Right.
But I think it is basically something that most Christians could relate to.
Exactly.
You know, that tension of like, it's not like he comes home and says, oh, darn,
right,
I have to take care of these three girls. He wants to, when he's in the presence of his three little girls, to do anything he can for them.
Exactly.
And, you know, when he's out of their presence, it's a little harder to look at all the jam you're making and right. being like, I'm not a jam maker.
Right. Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, where do you think that middle ground is? Or like, how do you feel that is that a decent metaphor, or is that a good example of kind of like what, someone who is a Christian like struggles with on a daily basis?
Yeah. So, I mean, 1 Corinthians 5 talks about becoming a new creation. So the reality of faith is that it recreates. It's a process and it's an event. So for someone who has changed their ways, they've turned over a new life. Where I grew up, they used to say, boy, have you got religion yet? You know, whatever it is the phrase to get you there. That once that happens, how do you live that way for the rest of your life? And that's what I saw a theme in here that wasn't really fully developed, because it's hard to answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a great old phrase that actually Martin Luther used, a Latin phrase. He used in the Latin, it says, simul justus et peccator. In English, it's at the same time, we're a sinner and a saint. In other words, we'll never be as good as we should be. We'll never be as bad as we could be. And there's this tension in us of, I want to live for myself, but I know I've got to live for others, or I've got to be selfless or loving. And that's not an easy tension. And what's fascinating is now that he's gotten married, he gets to live that out on a daily basis, you know? So.
Well, what I saw was, or what I guess what I felt, you mm-hmm. know, because I didn't really process it till much later,
mm-hmm.
is that that tension isn't, it's like better than just having a character who's good.
Right.
You know, it makes him relatable.
Exactly.
It makes him honest.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder what I would choose in the same situation.
Right.
And especially when he has to come up against, what are you created to do and what do you think you're created to do?
Right.
You know, because I think maybe he had to relearn how or what being a spy meant. Yeah. You know, he could use his powers for good, even though he seemed to be heavily influenced one of the things that I didn't really care for was the fact that, like, he was convinced because of his love for his girl. Was it Margot?
Yeah.
The oldest one?
Yeah.
He was convinced because of his love for Margot that El Macho was the, you know, the bad guy.
Right.
And I so wanted it to not be El Macho.
Yeah.
You know, because right. I wanted his love to blind him.
Right.
You know, to affect one or the other, because, you know, he can't have both his cake and eat it too.
Right.
When you talked about something that was a theme that wasn't as developed as it could have been, I felt like they kind of stopped short to,
right,
I guess, put the movie on a different trajectory.
They did.
I mean, we've already talked that he has changed. And we've talked that, you know, love kind of follows action.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, how do we know that he changed? I mean, is change just your actions? I mean, like, is, like when we were talking about like the metaphor for Christian life earlier, you know, is new life just you change what you do or you change how you feel?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question. And I honestly don't think the movie answered that for us. How do we know he really changed? I don't think that was their intention in the theme of it, but it's one of the applications that we see at work. This guy's obviously different than he was.
Mm-hmm.
And what was confronting him with that was this selflessness. Like if you watched how he interacted with Lucy at the first, mm-hmm. she was a bother, get away. And then by the end, of course, you know, a minister marries them in the last scene.
Yeah.
With, of course, the Darling Minion singing a Lone Star song, you know, in Spanish, I think. So it was all cute. But that whole transformation in him of his relationship with Lucy, I think revealed the change in him. That he wanted to love this person and be loved by this person. And so I think love is one of those tangible identifiers of a changed heart.
Well, when we see him get that changed heart, you say that Lucy's a very like visual representation that he changed. I guess taking a look at how they got together in the first place.
Right.
I felt could have been explored more.
Right.
Because I felt like there was almost like a switch that was flipped. And besides a wacky night where they heavily physically abuse
right.
a woman,
a
that
chicken.
Not the chicken, but the woman that was on
a
date with.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
Did your kids have questions about that?
You know, I didn't talk to them about that part.
That's not how we treat women.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Even accidentally.
I need to go back.
Even accidentally.
Back. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I really connected with, in that relationship was the fact that, they both stuck out like sore thumbs.
Mm-hmm.
You've already talked about how Gru wasn't like attractive. You know, obviously
right.
he doesn't have a very sunny disposition.
Right.
You know, but there was something there. And what it really kind of pointed to me was the fact that I think at some point they become comfortable with who they are.
Exactly.
And then they're comfortable being around other people.
Exactly.
And that really just kind of struck me because I feel like that's something that movies try to do. But ultimately, when we see that happen, it's between like two really beautiful people.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I'm finally comfortable being really beautiful
right.
and really talented.
Right.
And this other person who's really beautiful and really talented finally realizes that they're awesome too. So
yeah.
we should get together and have beautiful children.
Right, right.
And I think it doesn't hardly ever happen in non-animated movies.
Right.
But in animated movies, it gives them this license to have characters that aren't like, I want to say attractive,
right.
but that's almost being judgmental, you know, but like, you know, they're not,
you don't expect
they're not
them
princesses.
To be. Yeah.
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 And you're completely fine with that. Everyone's rooting
yeah.
for them to get together
exactly.
yet. They're not like,
right.
you know, Channing Tatum and whoever.
And there's a scene that I thought was really powerful where he's on the blind date or the date with the neighbor lady and he's wearing the wig and, you know, she tells him bald is, you look better bald or bald is beautiful, which
mm-hmm.
is comforting for us. For
comforting for you. I've got plenty more time.
You know,
before
so
I have to...
it's this affirmation that she accepts him for who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you can tell when they first meet, she's really exhilarated with what kind of criminal he is or his talent. You know,
his exploits.
The moon thing was
yeah.
fascinating. I'd like to talk about that more. To now she's accepted him for the person he is. And I thought that was a neat change that deals with that willingness on her part to accept him for who he was and not something else. So,
well, I love the, I'll get to that in my favorite moments. I'm not going to skip ahead.
Okay.
The last time we skipped ahead and I was not good that we skipped ahead. What other kinds of things did you catch from this movie?
Oh gosh, probably in this movie, the second one, the theme of existentialism was really powerful for Gru, of course. What's his purpose in life?
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's why I think it diminished the movie a little bit from what we saw in the first one, is that it really was about his personal happiness. I mean, we really didn't even see much of Lucy's development as a character, mm-hmm. other than she's just kind of this goofy antic. It was Gru. What's he really want in life? Why does he need a job? I mean, if he's already wealthy and he's got these three girls and everything he wants, he's unsatisfied with that. He's unsatisfied that he doesn't have a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Go down the list. So there's this theme in us in the movie that I saw, this need to have meaning and purpose and contentment, i.e. existentialism, that was, you know, the better movie would be Despicable Me 3 when we see Gru and Lucy fighting, because mm-hmm. they're having conflict in marriage, you know, and
that
how
happens.
That's not the end all be all of our existence. It's a great thing and a wonderful thing. So I felt like the movie was really about what makes Gru happy in life.
Well, when you talk about it like that, it actually makes me think of one of the most touching scenes, and how that might have almost been disappointing as a conclusion, because the thing that really, or one of the scenes that really got me, was when Gru and Agnes are sitting on the front porch and it was getting ready to rain or whatever.
Mm.
And she just is like, you know, is there anything I can do?
Yeah.
You know, basically to make you happy.
Right.
And then, you know, her next question is there anything you could do?
Exactly.
And it kind of puts the onus, saying like, if you're not happy, you're the only person
right.
preventing you from being
right.
happy.
Right.
And I would, you know, I would say that happiness is temporary. Happiness is fleeting. And anything that we can do is only going to be temporary.
Right.
And I would hate to come away from a movie like this and say that I'm responsible
for my own happiness.
Yeah, for my eternal,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
my life happiness.
Right.
Because I just don't think it's going to last. I mean, he's going to get Lucy, and like you said, in Despicable Me 3, he's going to regret
right.
Lucy a time or two.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, his happiness seeking it's not something that's meant to last.
Exactly.
And so the scene hits me because, you know, it proves that he does need to take a step in that direction,
mm-hmm.
but it almost is like it answers it as that's the ultimate answer.
Right.
And that's one of the where I find that it kind of falls short.
Exactly.
Which stinks, because I love that scene so much.
I know. Yeah.
You know?
That's a great scene.
When we start talking about great scenes, almost all of my scenes have to do with when Gru's interacting with his family. And I think it's a shame that, kind of like you're saying, we didn't get a lot of development with Lucy. I think even though Dr. Nefario is not family, he's kind of family.
He's like the uncle.
He's like adopted family.
Yeah, exactly.
And we don't get to see much Dr. Nefario. He's kind of like a device at the beginning that you know is going to come back at the end.
Right.
And, you know, do something.
Day.
And we don't get to see Agnes, Edith, and Margot
right.
that much. I mean, we do occasionally, they kind of pop up. But, like, we have, what, Edith, like, running around with a ninja sword the whole time?
Yeah.
And nothing ever happens with
right.
her.
And none.
I'm like, what? Or we have Margot kind of being interested in boys, which we get mentioned once or twice. And we even have her being, I guess, seduced in the way a teenager can be seduced.
Right.
But then...
Let's go get a cookie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they skip a scene later and suddenly he's on... You know, they never run with it.
Right.
They're just one scene... They're infatuated. Next, boys are stupid. And boys are stupid. And I think that's...
Exactly.
And I hope that's what you're teaching, you know, your girl.
Yeah. I really liked a favorite scene. It happened two or three times. Was Edith saying, "Oh, yuck." Mm-hmm. You know, that because I've got kids, little guys, who the idea of kissing is yucky and all mm-hmm. that. As a parent, I love that scene because, you know... If I kiss Angela Kay, they all go, "Oh, yuck." And so I really, that was a fun scene for me.
Well, full disclosure, Angela Kay being your wife.
Yes, that's right. Full disclosure.
For those people who didn't know.
That's right.
So, I mean, like, we talk about the importance of family. And one of the big things was the development of that family in the first movie. And I didn't really see a progression of that family in the second movie.
Exactly.
And for a movie that I thought was trying to tell me that kind of like family is the most important thing, or family is the greatest adventure you can be on, mm-hmm. or, you know, like being a spy is nothing compared to the challenge of raising three daughters.
Yeah.
I felt like they kind of dropped the ball on that. I mean, like, did you, like, as a parent, did you feel like, oh, I can relate to this as a parent because all these parent things that
clearly,
he's going through?
Clearly. And I could really relate with Gru on this aspect. He's got this family, and he loves them, and he cares for them. It's clear. But yet, he's got the tension of what he wants to be and become. And it's the, you know, this story plays itself over and over again. The father who works too much and, you know, is never around for his family, mm-hmm. loses his family. Or the father who works too much, loses his job, and now he gets close to his family. Where what I saw was, like you said, it was an opposite direction. That it was really the unifying thing of the family became Gru's personal happiness. And that was disappointing.
You don't find that's the way that your family works?
No.
All your children work for your personal happiness?
No, it's all competing interests. You know, they've got their agenda and their things, and I've got the things in my life that I want to do and my agenda, and I constantly have to temper it or give it away for the family. And it's worth it in the end, but it creates a tension.
Much like the tension we were talking about before, you know, you love your children. You want to be selfless for them. It hurts maybe at the time.
Right.
Because you still do have dreams that you want to accomplish.
Exactly.
That don't specifically involve your children.
Right.
But you, yeah. We're all on the same page now.
Yeah.
If in audience land you didn't catch that exchange, then just trust me, you're on the same page.
That's right.
So, well, is there anything else that you wanted to hit on Despicable Me 2?
That was a little, you know, whenever I watch movies, I have those moments where I go, that was far-fetched.
Okay. We have come on moment or
oh,
come on
we?
Moments coming on.
Okay.
So
I'll wait.
If that's all you have left, we can move to that.
That's all I had left.
Okay. Well, then I want to invite you every show. We have the come on moment, like something wasn't done quite right or, like,
right.
You know, or it left you hanging or it was far-fetched, or something that could have happened that stopped the movie 5 minutes in and resolved the entire plot. You know, things like that. So,
yeah.
With that explanation, Alan Hawkins.
The come-on moment was definitely that this serum, which had been created in this secret lab on Antarctica, could instantly be reversed with no side effects and sprayed on people's mouths and change them just within a matter of seconds. That was a... Really? You know, there's rocket ships full of hundreds of mm-hmm. minions, and in 2 minutes or less, the world is saved, and all the minions are back to good, and that was a little too much.
So you did not like the plot device serum, or even better, maybe the Deus Ex Machina serum?
Right.
Let's just go ahead and resolve the movie, because...
No.
Yeah. No. Well, I didn't... That didn't bother me as much, because at the time I was so... taken out of the movie by the minions, and that I mean, like I said, because I felt like I wanted to spend more time with the family,
right.
And more time, you know, just developing Gru and Lucy's relationship.
Yeah,
that it seemed almost like the El Macho subplot, or well, the El Macho plot,
right,
was actually a subplot,
exactly.
And I couldn't tell which one I was supposed to be the one that led to the other, or vice versa,
right.
And so, it didn't bother me as much, only because I feel like I should have been more involved,
yeah,
but I wasn't.
I agree.
But my moment was a moment that I think was missed. And I think it was done as well as it could have been for what they showed. But they set up this scene, you know, where Agnes is talking like a zombie about
mm-hmm.
her mother that she does not have, does
right.
not feel for, and could not understand.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, man, you know, Lucy's going to do something.
Yeah.
And be there and show her what that is.
We never saw that.
And we never see it.
Yeah.
Not only do we never see it, but they remind us that we've never seen it when she stands up at the wedding and says, my mom is duh, my mom is duh, my mom is all these things. And Lucy, thank you for being this mom. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
You mean, never
he just saved her from a rocket. Y'all haven't even been a family yet.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah.
That was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Instead of just being like, oh, that's sweet. I could have been like... babbling like a baby, you know,
right.
Just like trying to like kind of do that guy thing where I turn to the side so, you know, the ladies on the row can't see me, you know,
yeah,
having the tears roll down the side of the face. And it was a complete miss to me.
Yeah. So what I what I reflect on that is Lucy's character was never intended to bless or redeem the kids. It was to bless or redeem Gru. Mm-hmm. So he had this mother who said he was ugly mm-hmm. and spoke harshly against him. And now here's Lucy who comes in and is the anti-mother, the one who affirms him and loves him and believes in him. And so Lucy's character was never really, I think, for the family. It was for Gru.
Which I completely agree with.
It was a missed moment.
But why would they pretend like it was?
Yeah.
So, I mean, so my come on moment.
It almost been better if they wouldn't have gotten married mm-hmm. and they would have left with, you know, they saved the day and Despicable Me 3 is yeah. going to be, you know,
them getting together.
Parent Trap.
Yeah.
You know, Lucy comes into the family, the kids are mean to her, they're jealous. Mm-hmm.
You know, taking up Gru's time.
Right, right.
Exactly. Yeah. And see, this is why we should have wrote this movie, Alan.
Right.
Okay, so then we move from there, like almost the most disappointing moment to a certain degree, to favorite moment. This is the moment that stuck with you, or basically you couldn't stop thinking about, or kind of makes you smile kind of to yourself.
I mentioned it earlier. The scene on the playground really was a powerful scene for me. If you've ever been embarrassed and humiliated in a situation like that, when mm-hmm. you know, obviously likes this girl and he just gets destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, I like that scene because it reminds me of the power of that experience. But also, it stuck with me. It was probably my favorite scene. Because it also shows me the power of redemption and how Lucy, again, redeems Gru from that pitiful experience. I mean, I think somewhere in the movie it's mentioned he's never dated.
Because mm-hmm. so, he doesn't want to.
Right. His first attempt, crash and burn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now here's Lucy who comes in and redeems that situation. So that was probably my favorite scene in the movie.
So I'm starting to wonder if you do have some kind of direct connection with the Lord, because you start describing like the most depressing scene and like it is pouring down rain outside.
It is.
And so I'm not even sure if that'll show up, but it is crazy raining right now.
Right.
Okay. So just to recap, your favorite scene was one of the most depressing scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. That's pretty much sums up my personality.
Well, and I didn't mention this before. I was going to talk about it, but I wanted to save it for my favorite moment. I love, especially in animated movies, we've already talked about how putting the truth right up front
mm-hmm.
or putting the narrative or the feelings of characters right up front, not trying to hide it with right. like, oh, only adults can understand this.
Right.
Those are my favorite moments in animated movies. And I think the penultimate is an Up. You know,
yeah.
like... How can you make people feel like what it is to love someone more than you love yourself?
Exactly.
Watch the first, you know, 15 minutes of Up.
Right.
Well, in this movie,
the first 5 minutes, you're talking about where he runs through the scene of the wife and their life.
Oh yeah, their whole life.
Yeah, yeah, I'm crying by the
oh,
end.
Oh yeah,
of
yeah. You know, so that right there is an example of like usually what my favorite stuff in animated movies is, because they don't hide it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not trying to make you watch for an hour and a half to go, I think they liked each other.
Right.
You know, they're like, boom.
Yeah.
And they put it right out front. And I think they often do that with children's movies. And that's what I like, because they usually can visually show something that they can't in non-animated movies.
Exactly.
So in Despicable Me 2, when he kind of realizes that he is in love, he has this jaunt.
Yeah.
Through like the park. And
right.
He's doing everything perfect. And then, you know, he kind of gets there, realizes that she's moving on, and that ship has sailed, or might have sailed.
Yeah.
And he is completely destroyed.
Yeah.
And then they have that, you know, that kind of whole scene where he goes back and
kicks the garage,
yeah,
the can, yeah.
He is destroyed. And I love that,
yeah.
Not because I like the fact that he ends up being destroyed, or particularly because he realizes his love, but because that stuck with me about like a scene where I felt like Gru felt.
Yeah.
And I understood.
Exactly.
And then I felt how destroyed he was.
Right.
And they captured that
yeah.
in this scene. And I just thought that was really great. I mean, and I really also like the scene on the steps with Agnes because, I mean, it showed Agnes basically being like, my happiness isn't penultimate. Your happiness is what I care about more than anything. Right. And, I mean, like I said, that got to me. Yeah. I was like, I want a little girl.
Right.
Who comes up to me and asks me sweet things. Well, with that, with our favorite scenes, is there anything else you want to add about Despicable Me or Despicable Me 2? Children's movies, we've kind of hit on a couple things.
One thing that was silent from the movie is the, obviously he's a single parent, from a single parent home, and how there's this issue of father, it's the unspoken issue of fatherhood that I found interesting. That he never had a father. He didn't have a model of a father. So he was stumbling through it to figure it out. But how that was not really emphasized, this father aspect that he plays. He's more like their good buddy, you know, than their father.
Yeah, yeah.
Until Margot starts getting interested in boys. All of a sudden, his fatherhood motivations or protections or whatever kick in. And I thought that was really fascinating.
So do you think that that's an accurate portrayal? Do you think people that, like, there's just this father instinct in all men
absolutely.
Who have little girls?
Yeah, I do.
With the
And you know, I've experienced that with my own daughter. Like, I'm fine if my boys will beat up on each other, but if anyone touches my daughter, I'll kill them. You know, that there's something
hyperbole. Just saying, even if it's not, we're going to pretend it's hyperbole. Right.
Love your neighbor. So in that sense, like, why does my protective instincts rise up for my daughter more than my son's? So
good.
Good
stuff. Well, we, like I said, we're winding down. And as our first, but probably not last, solo guest on the show, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did a great job, Alan.
It was great to be here.
Because you did such an amazing job.
As long as I did a better job than Elijah Lovejoy.
Y'all are going to have to fight that out. Y'all can do that on Sunday morning. I'll sell tickets, put it on pay-per-view,
and then
we can have a theological discussion about it.
Exactly.
People will probably be interested in following what you're doing, kind of what you're involved in. So how can people get interested in whatever you're doing or follow?
Oh, yeah, that's great. So, you know, something I've been involved in for about 2 or 3 years that's really near and dear to my heart, because I think these kinds of topics and issues are so worthy to talk about. And I think one of the best places to talk about them is in the context of a faith community. So I'm real excited to help new faith communities start. And I'm a part of an initiative called Anglican 1000, our website, Anglican1000.org. It's really seen 1,000 new Anglican churches started in North America that are teaching these great truths and helping people to see that the issues of their life are really issues of their heart and our faith issues as well. So Anglican1000.org, we've got a conference coming up in Seattle next week. And
I heard that's going to be a great one.
It's going to be a great one, yes.
You haven't got on the Twitters yet, have you?
Right, yeah.
I haven't convinced you yet.
No.
We'll talk about that after
another
the show.
Time, yes.
Well, anyone who's interested in getting a hold of Alan, I will put his information at the Anglican 1000 site in the show notes. And if you'd like to continue interacting with us, give us ideas for movies that you'd like to see, feel free to email us at podcast@realworldtheology.com. You can go to the website, realworldtheology.com, and see reviews of other movies, see live events that we have coming up. We actually have one coming up this Friday, depending on when you see this. I think that's Friday, August 2nd. I don't even know when my own live event is. So August 2nd, we're going to be showing Shaun of the Dead and having a conversation after that movie. That's going to be fun. So you can find out when that kind of stuff is, events. You can also download the podcast. You can also go to iTunes and subscribe to our Real World Theology feed. Get every new podcast whenever they come out. Right now, we're looking at doing about 2 a month. That's kind of how it's working out. We've got a lot of really interesting people like Alan, like some of our previous guests, who are very excited about coming on and talking about movies that have been coming out. I don't want to give too much away, but I will probably slowly over Twitter be talking about some of the shows that we have coming up in the next couple months to get some people excited, get some questions. So if you want to follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Exactly. I still got that. See, I've got Twitter.
I couldn't think of a cool name.
That like the Hawkinator?
No. Not cool.
Hawkication?
Not cool.
No. Okay. So if you feel so inclined, follow us there. If you follow us on, or if you subscribe to our feed in iTunes, please leave us a 5-star review. It'll help us get our name out there. People can find us. People can also join the conversation. And that's what most of this is about. Just joining the conversation, realizing that movies have a lot more to offer than just a babysitter for 2 hours. Or, something to take, turn your mind off of after a long day. I mean, they really do have these themes, these narratives that affect how we see, how we feel, everything we do in life. So with that, I will sign off for episode 4. And until next time, guys, I just want to remind you that entertainment is not mindless.